Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is a republic if you can keep it, with former Democratic Party Chairman Mark Brewer and former Republican Party Executive Director Jeff Timmer.
I'm Jeff Timmer, but you can call me Eric.
And I'm Mark Brewer, but you can call me Eric. Welcome to I'm the Eric edition of A Republic If You Can Keep It.
We're recording on Wednesday, August 3rd, and the Eric joke was in regard to Donald Trump's endorsement of Eric in the Missouri Senate primary, where there were three Erics running. One, the former governor, one, the current attorney general, and one, just another guy named Eric. But nonetheless, Trump hedged his bet and endorsed Eric, and they all claimed the mantle. Only one of them won. You know, yesterday was primary election day in Michigan. Turned out to be very fascinating. And across the country in some other states, like Missouri, like Arizona, like Kansas. We'll talk about all that in a few minutes. Former Michigan Lieutenant Governor and longtime state senator John Cherry will join the conversation for an analysis of yesterday's results. But let's start with Kansas. But let's and talk about abortion here. You know, we've got so much going on in Michigan with abortion. But the big marquee race that's captured the nation happened yesterday in Kansas. Mark, why don't you tell us a little bit about that ballot initiative?
Yeah. So, you know, Kansas is the home of so many things, Jeff. Right. The Wizard of Oz. And there was a famous book for us Democrats a few years ago that said, what's wrong with Kansas? As Kansas started to slip away from us as Democrats. Well, now I think Democrats and Republicans, and frankly, as you just said, everybody across the country is saying, what the heck happened in Kansas yesterday? But to set it up, people should know that the state Supreme Court in Kansas a few years ago recognized a right to abortion up to approximately 22 weeks. And that's the law of Kansas. There was a proposal on the ballot yesterday to let the legislature impose its own version of what abortion should be legal or illegal in Kansas. And it was really odd because if you opposed that proposal and you supported abortion, you were supposed to vote no. But if you were a so-called pro-life person, you're supposed to vote yes. So it got confusing. And some of the sides took advantage of that. So that was the setting. Primary election, supposed to be a low turnout election, you know, and that's, I think, the pro-life forces thought this is a perfect setup for us to overturn that Supreme Court decision. All the polling indicated that it was going to be close, that it could go either way. What did we get last night? I think it was roughly a 60% plus blowout not to adopt that amendment. So to leave the abortion status quo in place in Kansas. And I think it's safe to say nobody saw this coming. I was talking with some friends yesterday and they said, oh, Mark, what's going to happen in Kansas? I said, oh, I'm really worried that we're going to lose. And it was just stunning last night. And I think there's going to be a lot of work that needs to be done there, Jeff, in terms of who are these people that turned out? Were there Republicans who voted pro-choice? Were there new voters? Infrequent voters, because Democrats, other than that ballot proposal, had no incentive to come out. But that may have been enough by itself to drive them out. I mean, the turnout levels were just extraordinary across the state. So anyway, to answer your question, yes, we're quite happy. We on the pro-choice side, and I'm part of the constitutional amendment here, but also part of the ongoing litigation where we had some more success today. But anyway, so I think there are some lessons to be learned. Obviously, Michigan is not Kansas. You know, very different here. But that's very, very encouraging in terms of what it showed. I think the power that's been unleashed by the fact that Supreme Court overturned Roe. And now for the first time in 50 years, these fundamental rights that we've all come to take for granted are very much threatened. And you saw the pushback on that yesterday. I hope that's a harbinger of what happens across the country, and particularly here in Michigan.
Well, I think that's a great, I'd like to talk a little bit about what's going on here in Michigan, where for the first time in 50 years, abortion is going to be on the November ballot. And it is going to be a huge issue, even bigger than in many states, where it's a ginormous issue because of the Dobbs decision overturning Roe. But in Michigan, people are actually going to be able to turn out and vote on the issue. And, you know, clearly Michigan is much more purple than rock red Kansas. And if you mentioned the turnout that it was experienced in Kansas yesterday, I mean, there were not just there were some of the suburban counties in far eastern Kansas that border Kansas City, Missouri, you know, kind of those more traditional suburban counties that had huge turnout. That's where if there's a battleground in area in Kansas, that's where it is. Massive turnout. But even in the far western parts of Kansas, the reddest part, some of the reddest parts of the country, we saw a turnout increase in counties 50, 75, 100%. More voters than in 2018. And when you match, and these weren't people that were turning out in the red counties too. And I'm not saying that even these are people who don't want to criminalize. That's the way I read it. They take the position. They don't want to criminalize women, girls, doctors involved in abortion. They might be personally opposed to it. They might be opposed to it in a lot of ways, but that was a bridge too far for them. And that's where I think people are still sifting through and sorting out and how that might translate into other states. Now, you know, with the Michigan ballot proposal, I know you're involved with that. You're also involved in lawsuits regarding abortion here in Michigan. Just kind of tell us where we're at, you know, here on August 3rd. What's going on in Michigan, and what can we expect to see in these next few days or few weeks before we get into the certification of the signatures in the actual campaign for the fall?
I think the campaigns are going to, they have to start, right? Because we all know absentee ballots go out third week of September. So folks are not going to be able to wait. I think the major anti group has already reserved like $9 million in TV time for the fall. So this is going to be a battle royal. But not only was yesterday, I think, encouraging for the pro-choice forces, but I think it might have been a wake-up call to like Right to Life and the Catholic Conference. I think their analogs in Kansas got taken by surprise yesterday. They may have taken things for granted. So I don't think that's going to happen here in Michigan. I think it's going to be a very vigorous fight. And I think it's going to come down to who successfully frames the issue. And this is something you're really good at, right? I mean, we have people like Tudor Dixon saying no exceptions, even for rape and incest. And of course, this 31 law, which is at issue here, is a criminal statute. And it doesn't have exceptions for rape and incest either. So I think it's important about, you know, again, the framing of it. Are you supportive of that law? Are you somebody like a Tudor Dixon? I think those are the kind of views that people in Kansas rejected yesterday, Jeff, because the people who rejected those views were worried that that was exactly what that legislature was going to do. That if you free the legislature to do that, they're not going to be moderates. They're going to go to the extreme. And so I think that's going to be the battle here. But the problem for the Republicans, Tudor Dixon and DiPerno's even worse. He doesn't even have an exception for the life of the mother. Is that how they're going to walk away from those views? I mean, they're on record on those views, and there are already ads starting to run in the state talking about them and excerpts from interviews with them about that. So I'm sorry I'm so impassioned about this issue, because it's important to me personally and to many, many folks, but it's going to be a battle royal, and those of us on the pro-choice side can't take it for granted. Right to Life, the Catholic Church here, which has been a big supporter of this issue over the years, they're not just going to roll over and play dead. They're going to try to frame the issue in their way in terms of what the ballot proposal says. And again, it's going to come down to that, Jeff, a battle of whose frame the voters believe.
Before that ballot initiative or the constitutional amendment is voted on, we've got some jockeying going on in the courts regarding the enforcement of the 1931 law. I mean, so far since the Dobbs decision, since Roe was overturned, there have been court rulings in place that have effectively prohibited the prosecution under that law, while the Supreme Court considers the suit that was brought by Governor Whitmer and others. Then there was a panel of the Court of Appeals who said, no, you can go ahead and enforce. Now there's emergency injunction. I'm not a lawyer. I'm around just enough lawyers enough to be dangerous. But what does this mean? Could a prosecutor right now, does a judge in Oakland County have weight in Jackson County or Kent County? Can a prosecutor there say, no, I, the Court of Appeals said I can do this. I'm doing it.
Just to cut through all this, abortion remains legal in Michigan, even though there's all this fighting going on. On behalf of Planned Parenthood, I'm one of several lawyers representing Planned Parenthood. We got an injunction against the statewide criminal law, and we got that even before the Dobbs decision came down. That remains in effect. Now, there were a couple of judges on the Court of Appeals this week that's cast some doubt about the validity of that. The group of lawyers representing Planned Parenthood have taken that decision to the Michigan Supreme Court that got filed today to get clarification. But in the meantime, the governor's lawyers, who have a separate case pending in Oakland County, went into court on Monday and got a court order from there that binds 13 prosecutors in the state, including the most vocal ones, Macomb County, Jackson, Kent. They've been the most vociferous about this, and says you shall not enforce the 31 law. And just today, the judge extended that order for another almost 3 weeks to at least August 14th. So that's some additional assurance on top of the original injunction. That, again, abortion remains legal. Planned Parenthood is still operating, as are other providers out there. And people should not be afraid to exercise the right to reproductive freedom. But the battle will continue. I have no doubt that, right to life, and the legislature. The legislature is now in these cases arguing on behalf of the 1931 law. But I have no doubt that legal battle is going to continue.
I guess this is a long way of coming around to saying those on the Republican side who think this election is going to only be about how much inflation has gone up, how much the price of gas is, are seriously misreading the room when it comes to the overall context of the election. Abortion is going to play a huge role, and it's not one that I think favors the Republican position, Tudor Dixon's position. I would much rather be Gretchen Whitmer, Dana Nessel, and the Democrats with their position on abortion, because I think it is reflective of a majority of Michigan voters, including a wide swath of Republicans who have a problem with criminalizing abortion. And that's something we've talked about a lot on this podcast. But let's switch gears. Let's talk about, we had some big congressional primaries in Michigan. And I know you had at least one client involved in the Stevens-Levins race, but we had the open 13th congressional. We had the primary race with Rashida Tlaib, and we had the Peter Meyer race. So why don't we start by talking about the three Southeast Michigan Democratic primaries and what you see and saw in those races.
In the 10th district, which is that Macomb County-based district, comes a little bit into Oakland County. Marlinga, the former county prosecutor, was the favorite. He won, and that sets up now a big race with John James, who hasn't won an election in Michigan, doesn't even live in the district, lives dozens of miles away over in Oakland County.
Hasn't won that district in either of his failed
right. And he did lose that. But I expect it to be a big battle. I think the Republican National Congressional Committee and the Democrat equivalent will come in there, and it'll be a real proxy war between the two of those. And that's a competitive district. There's no question about it. And so we'll have to see how that plays out in the fall. But that's what happens when you got redistricting, right? These lines change dramatically, and that's one result of that. But Jeff, I want to get your thoughts, though, on what happened in West Michigan yesterday with Congressman Meyer, who had the courage to vote for impeachment. Looks like he might have paid the price for that, though.
Yeah, I think that the fact that Meyer lost the primary, I think that die was cast on the day he voted for impeachment back at the beginning of 2021. He was as long as he was in a one-on-one battle, with a Trump-endorsed candidate, that impeachment vote was enough to seal his fate. And so the result to me wasn't surprising. In fact, it was a little closer than I thought it would be. I thought Gibbs, who was the Trump-endorsed candidate, he raised virtually no money. He ran an amateurish, shitty campaign, and none of that mattered because I think the outcome was predetermined. A lot of attention has been given in the last, 72, 96 hours to the fact that the Democratic congressional campaign arm came in and interfered in the race, trying to orchestrate John Gibbs becoming the nominee. Would rather run against Gibbs. They feel that gives Hillary Scolton a better chance to win than running against Pete Meyer. I don't think anything they did mattered. I don't think it changed I don't think that Meyer lost because the DCCC got involved. People can debate whether or not they should have done that or not. The DCCC exists to elect Democrats. There are people like me who are concerned about the greater arc toward, democracy. Peter Meyer winning that race is, had he won, had he been reelected, he's not the existential threat to democracy, arguably, that a John Gibbs is. But, he's lost. It's over. I think it's very telling that that's where the Republican Party is. It's fealty to Donald Trump. He committed the cardinal sin of voting to remove Donald Trump from office. That was a bridge too far for Republican voters, even in kind of a pinky up, nice West Michigan, where the politics has usually not been so bare knuckled and incumbents don't lose.
Yeah, but that reference to money upset that the DCCC played in that race. I want to remind people that goes both ways, because back over in Southeast Michigan, in the Stevens-Levin race, there were a lot of Republican millionaires playing in that race against Andy Levin. Full disclosure, good friend of mine, but his record got smeared, he got slandered. He got outspent overwhelmingly on TV by this group of Republican millionaires, and he lost yesterday. It's not taking anything away from Haley Stevens. I think she's a fine congresswoman. But it was unfortunate that it had to end up that way, with that outside money having such a big factor. So both parties are doing this, and not just in Michigan. We've seen it around the country, for good or for ill. That's where we are.
Yeah, I've been involved in the caucus committees, these big campaigns where you're moving chess pieces around the board. You're looking at how do you maximize your position and get the end up on November 8th with the most seats. And you're right, both sides. This isn't always a fight above the belt. Do things the way that everybody in polite society would like to see done. This is bare knuckle politics. Both sides play it. Both sides do it from time to time. And I really think that we talked about the James Marlinga race that hasn't gotten as much attention as some of these other congressional districts in Michigan. But I think that calculus kind of changes the perspective for Washington, because Peter Meyer losing changes the overall chessboard. Now, the Democrats aren't a guaranteed lock to win that third district now that Pete Meyer has lost, but their odds have improved significantly and they're the prohibitive favorite. So that might mean that there's more resources that would have been dedicated to that seat had Peter Meyer won that are now available to back Carl Marlinga in the race against John James. So that's how a race like that is. They're not isolated. They have ripple effect on the overall chessboard. And there's other examples. And it's not just what happens in Michigan. It's races all across the country that how they move the money around that chessboard. And so I really think the people in John James orbit who are measuring the drapes in the Cannon office building or the Longworth office building, whichever one they think they're going to get, are a little premature. He's raised a shit ton of money. He's a great recruit for the Republicans. I give them that. But he is a proven record of losing in Michigan, losing in that district. Great. If he can get to 48%, that's something. But you got to get to 50%. He's never done that before. Carl Marling has.
before we turn to Detroit, just to throw into your calculus there, we both know this, that we've got two Democratic incumbents, Slatkin and Kildee, that are in much more competitive districts than they were in. And that's part of the national calculus as well, because they're both going to need resources to defend themselves. I think we're going to see more than we've seen in a long time, a lot more money and attention paid to Michigan congressional races, because you're talking about potentially half a dozen, five or six races, which there could be national money. But let's talk about Detroit.
Sure.
So we have in the new 13th district a race which pitted Sri Thanadar, the self-made multimillionaire, Indian American by background, running against eight African American candidates, some with well-established names in Detroit, others who are office holders, past or present as well. And Thanadar wins the primary with less than 30% of the vote. That's the way our system works, right? You don't have to get a majority. We don't do runoffs in Michigan. It's whoever gets the most votes in a low turnout race. And it seems to me that's not entirely unpredictable. Thanadar spent an enormous amount of money on that race. I frankly was surprised he didn't do better given all the money that he spent. I think he should have done better given all that money. But Jeff, we know from your redistricting work, you know a lot more about Detroit than you let on. So give us your reflections on the 13th district primary yesterday.
I've said for years that campaigns, when you break them down, are actually very simple things. They require money and everything else. And if you do those things right, then you're in better position to win. And Thanadar had the money, clearly. And, it was an enormous amount of money relative to everybody else in the field. Probably he probably spent twice what everybody else in the field spent combined, or more than
that.
So yes. An exponential factor of spending, but that spending bought him the everything else. He had it different than when he first ran for governor in 2018, in which he won the city of Detroit in the Democratic primary. That should be noted. But since then, he's got elected to a state house seat there. He's established an electoral base. So he was running from a position of much significantly more strength than he had in 2018. And so the outcome isn't that surprising. There was a rallying of endorsements and money and organizations behind Senator Adam Hollier. But the fact that there were so many other names on the ballot, Sharon McPhail, John Conyers III, Portia Roberson, there were just so many well-known names that peeled off, 10% of the vote, 12% of the vote, 8% of the vote, it adds up. And had any one of those candidates not run, Hollier would have probably been the beneficiary of their vote and would probably have won. It was that close. I mean, it was like 4.5 percentage points that separated Hollier and Thanadar, I think, where we're at right now. So it wasn't that he won going away. He won narrowly by a few thousand votes in a low turnout election. And any number of factors could have tipped the results. So it was fascinating to watch out. At the end of the day, in most races, the candidate who is able to spend the most and have the most robust activity often ends up winning. Surprise. Kevin Rinke might think otherwise, but Thanadar won. It will be interesting to see if he's able to consolidate his position, and if he find he'll in 2 years, does he face a primary that's less divided from the Detroit political world? Does he get a one-on-one against a Hollier or somebody else, which would be a whole different ballgame and would be more like some of the races we've seen in the past where incumbents have been toppled. They emerge from a crowded primary, and not just in Detroit, but I'm thinking of Joe Schwartz when Nick Smith retired in 2004. Joe Schwartz wins a very crowded primary on the Republican side with about 24% of the vote. And then 2 years later gets Tim Walberg in a one-on-one and loses 60-40. And so might we see that same kind of dynamic at work here? If I'm Sri Thanadar, I'd rent in Washington. I wouldn't buy yet.
Oh, I agree, Jeff. I think there's going to be a lot, and there already is. You see it in the press today. A lot of attention paid to what he does, a lot of expectations People are expecting that he's going to have to build a lot of bridges and build a lot of relationships. And you're right. I think he could be quite vulnerable to the right candidate if there's only one or two candidates in a primary in a couple of years.
As we wrap up our discussion on the primary results, I mean, there's, as always happens, there's winners and losers. And until you know, 2020, it really never dawned on any of us to, if our candidate lost, to say, we're not going to believe in that. We're not going to abide by the fact that we lost. We're going to pretend that we won. We're going to stomp our feet. We're going to go out and create a bunch of havoc. We're going to be like, you know, defeated fourth place Republican gubernatorial candidate Ryan Kelly. You finished a distant fourth. He's not conceding the race to Tudor Dixon. Well, whatever. He can not concede all he wants. He lost to her by about, you know, 250,000 fewer votes. So we see some examples, and Walt Sorg, our producer, shared with us the gracious letter. John Horford, who was a Democratic candidate in a Lansing area seat, lost a primary by just a handful of votes. I think like 7 votes or 12 votes or something really small, but sent out this very gracious congratulations to the victor, praising the work of his volunteers, the environment, wishing success and luck. That's how it's done. Even if you win close, I mean, it's a hard thing to do. I've been involved in many campaigns that have won and many campaigns that have lost. And when you're counting those votes, and especially when it's close, you think, oh my gosh, you know, it's a handful of votes. What could change here? The hardest thing to do is to go out in public after you've gone through that battle with your name on the line and be gracious when you're feeling pretty crappy. And you might be feeling aggrieved, like, oh, you know, if we count these again, there might be a different. John Horford knows the right thing to do. Most candidates know the right thing to do. They call and concede. Peter Meyer conceded last night to John Gibbs. And that's what you do when you lose. That's how our democracy works. You go on to fight the next fight.
Right. Yeah. And also, too, I mean, Andy Levin was very gracious last night after he lost. There were some hard fought primaries we've talked about.
Adam Holly, I saw his concession.
Holly.
Yep. Very gracious.
Senator Bullock lost to Senator McMorrow, but they ran a very positive campaign and both had very nice things to say about each other today. You're right, Jeff. Whether it's in a primary or in a general election, that's the way a democracy should function. You respect the results when it's over and you move on. You don't behave like Brian Kelly.
The conversation continues with former Lieutenant Governor John Cherry after these messages on A Republic, If You Can Keep It.
Epic MRA is pleased to be a sponsor of this podcast. Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm whose principals have more than 4 decades of experience measuring public opinion on federal, state, and local issues, from who's ahead in a race for governor or Congress to local support for a proposed zoning change.
Our clients include media outlets, school districts, state agencies, local governments, and membership organizations across the state. Whether it's measuring voter opinions about who's up or down in elections, or if ballot proposals or legislation enjoys public support, Epic MRA has been Michigan's premier go-to pollster for 30 years.
Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
When candidates and government leaders need the facts about their voters, they turn to practical political consulting.
PPC has served political candidates, organizations, campaigns, and businesses for more than 45 years. They work with savvy campaigns to provide the best voter lists available in Michigan, as well as campaign consulting, graphic design, and polling at competitive prices.
Over their storied history, PPC has worked with thousands of campaigns, providing them with, as the New York Times once said, quote, the best lists possible in this competitive state, along with unique and individualized strategy.
They've worked with small campaigns for rural school board, all the way up to occupants of the White House. They are also renowned for their work with ballot initiatives, both for challenges and protections.
Find out more. Go to www.practicalpoliticalconsulting.com or call 517-351-5105.
We're joined this week by the patriarch of a Michigan political dynasty, former Lieutenant Governor John Cherry, a former staff member to the Michigan State Senator Gary Corbin. Cherry served as the state political director for the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees until 1982, when he was elected to the state legislature as state representative and then later a state senator, where he became the Senate minority leader. He then served 8 years as lieutenant governor under Governor Jennifer Granholm.
You know, my friend John Cherry was well-respected, well-liked across the aisle, and was a key ally for Governor Granholm as she battled with legislative Republicans. He's the first in a long line of family members in state government with at least one Cherry family member in state office since 1983. His spouse, his sister, and son have all served in the Michigan legislature and are terrific public servants. And his sister continues her public service today as Genesee County Treasurer. His son, John, yesterday won the Democratic nomination for the state Senate out of a district in Genesee County after two terms in the state House. John Cherry, great to see you. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure, Mark. Good to see you again.
Yeah, we really wanted you on the day after the primary to take advantage of your vast experience and knowledge of Michigan politics, your reflections, excuse me, on what happened yesterday. So why don't we start at the top of the ticket? What do you think of the Republican gubernatorial primary and, you know, what happened yesterday with Tudor Dixon finally being the nominee?
But, you know, you kind of saw that coming, I think, 2 days out. I think all the endorsement bodies were wet with her in hopes that they would not be shut out. I mean, it was an interesting dynamic at work. But in the end, that primary, I think, was harmful to the ultimate victor, in the sense that, I mean, I was hearing at the polls yesterday a lot of Republican poll workers talking like she was Joe Biden. The whole notion that there's a lot of division out there. People want to win, and if their side's not winning, they want to take their ball and go home. And so, I mean, I think that all helps out Governor Whitmer, that at least a good portion of the next month or two is going to be spent trying to mend fences and put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And so I think there's an advantage to Governor Whitmer there.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Just that I think her August may be just as tougher, Dixon's August, than July was. Trying to put a coalition together of her Republican base. You know, she did have a big win relative to the second place finisher, nearly twice as many votes, but 60% of the Republican voters wanted somebody else other than Tudor Dixon. And the intensity of some of those voters, especially the Saldano, the Kelly, and the Remant voters, add up to a nearly 40%. These people were very fervent in their choice and very solidified and seemed to be kind of from top to bottom thinking that Dixon is an unacceptable choice. So it's going to be really interesting to see how she puts that coalition together and see how she navigates her choice for lieutenant governor. Gone are the days where she gets to say, this is who I want. This makes pragmatic sense. Oh, you know, Tom Leonard brings me male female balance and legislative experience. The convention delegates are rabid. They want red meat and they want the choice to be up to them, not spoon fed to them.
Yeah, this is not 20 years ago. You know, she has some heavyweights behind her that 20 years ago could begin to put this all back together for her. But as you say, Jeff, that's not how the game is being played today.
I mean, even this morning, Ryan Kelly refused to concede.
Right.
And he's out there, you know, demanding an audit, a recount. I mean, the Republicans seem to be reaping what they sowed for 2 years. They've been undermining our elections, and now they've got candidates, not just Kelly, but others, who are not conceding and are making all kinds of crazy allegations about election wrongdoing and election fraud and all this other kind of stuff. I don't know how you unite a party that's got that element inside it.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see too, Mark and John, how the we still have some logistics involved in the post-election, post-primary period. It's very likely that we see a county or two come to a standstill, a stalemate, and not be able to certify their election results. Some of this big lie nonsense is still likely to manifest itself and play out here in the coming days.
I wonder where those counties are going to be. I mean, I know, for instance, Genesee had some problems with the modems and then having to hand count ballots that would seem to be disruptive. But, you know, that county, given, you know, how it was played out, really doesn't impact that Republican gubernatorial campaign. I mean, it's not critical in terms of the Republican outcome. So I guess it depends upon where those issues took place.
Sure. And Genesee is a good example of after the 2020 election, there was a canvasser there, a county canvasser, who had a longtime party stalwart, Michelle Voorhees, somebody I used to work with when I ran the Republican Party in Michigan. She committed the cardinal sin. She certified the election and said Donald Trump lost. And so they ousted her and replaced her with somebody who said they wouldn't have certified the 2020 election and were skeptical about the validity of elections going forward. And so it's that kind of intentional wrench in the gears of democracy that the Republicans are deliberately implementing. And I think that's one of the kind of overarching dangers that our democracy faces right now, not just in Michigan, but in states across the country, where the people involved in the process, the administration of elections, if they come at this with a partisan tent, with malice intended, it really gums up the works and undermines the faith in democracy and really corrodes our faith in free and fair elections.
I think you're right. I mean, there's a number of these county boards around the state where the Republicans installed in the last couple of years election deniers. We got that problem in Macomb, I think Kalamazoo, and a number of other counties as well. And, you know, as you all know, the post-election calendar is very tight. These county boards have got to get this done in a couple of weeks so the Board of Canvassers can certify. And there's not any room for any of that kind of disruption either now or in November, where it could be a serious problem as well.
So what is the effect of that on, I mean, one of the battles here is going to be for control of the Michigan House and the control of the Michigan Senate. So what does the impact of that kind of dispute do on that? I mean, if you're going to say that this election was stolen, then all of your nominees that resulted from that stolen election are under question at that point.
No, I think that's right. You can throw that back at the Republicans, John, and, you know, but there's no room for delay here. You know, we got now, thanks to Prop 3 and 218, very early absentee ballot availability, you know, third week of September. And there's just not time for any of this kind of stuff. And it'll back up the process. The state board will have to come in, take over a canvas, or a lawsuit will get filed. They have to get a court order. I mean, we've never had that before, but that's the threat that Jeff is talking about. And it's a threat this month as well as, I think, next November.
I want to just kind of step back and look at things a little bit. We have a tendency, I think, when looking at politics and what's going on today, to liken this all to, oh, Donald Trump and the change in the last 6 or 7 years. But you have such a interesting background in Michigan politics, kind of spanning the era before term limits and serving after term limits in the legislature and then as lieutenant governor. Maybe if this is a, maybe I don't intend it to be a curveball, but tell me maybe about the changes you saw as an observer from the other side of the aisle in the politics of the Republican Party over the last few decades. I'll set it up a little better. I think there was a material change, a significant change in 1988 when God told Pat Robertson to run for president, and then the party co-opted the evangelical Pat Robertson people kind of morphed into brought a theological aspect to a secular Chamber of Commerce party that didn't exist prior to that to the extent that it did afterward. And so I think that was the beginning of the change. But I'd be curious on your perspective, the people you served with on the other side of the aisle, you know, there was the Dan DeGroes and Joe Schwartz and John Siskies and people like that. And then there were the, you know, the Dave Jays and Raul Jurcevics and Dale Sugars and, you know, Thad McCotters. So you saw them all.
A lot of things at play at work. I mean, one is the culture's changed. That's what you're talking about, Jeff. It's also the nature of politics having changed. For instance, I was there as a movement went towards leadership being the place where money was raised, as opposed to the raising of money being occurred at the local candidate level. And as leadership controlled those levers of power, all of a sudden the ability for an appropriations chair to decide what was going to happen in the appropriations committee began to disappear. So there's been some loss of power centers within the legislature. It's become more concentrated to the leadership level. And so as you get a cultural change, that magnifies that cultural change. And sometimes I think there, you know, I do think there are political nomads out there, and some of the people, some of the struggle that the current Michigan Republican Party faces is from people that the Democratic Party struggled with back during the George Wallace days. So, I mean, you know, there was some migration occurring and people looking for a home where they couldn't impact. I mean, if you couldn't impact the Democratic Party, you began to look for someplace else to play. And that's part of what's at work, too. Oftentimes I think reforms don't have a positive or negative effect. They're more neutral. But the fact is that term limits kind of reduced the tenure question. I mean, if you begin to work with somebody over 8 years, you begin to learn how to work with them. Today, as you begin to enter your legislative process, as you begin to learn the process, you're told to move on. And so you don't have that historical quality. I mean, yes, term limits results in a turnover, but you know what? The turnover under term limits isn't any greater than the turnover that occurred before. It's just that there were certain people who were good at the job, stayed there and taught those who came into the process about how to handle that. So, I mean, some of this change that's occurring is really outside the phenomenon of the evangelical movement, but that's coming to play in an environment that gives it some fertile soil.
Fascinating perspective. I just find it so interesting. I mean, I think you're right. The tenure that people serve in Lansing really hasn't changed that much since term limits. You know, 10, 12, 14 years was kind of the norm. The difference was you had time before term limits to figure out who was capable and who wasn't before they became a committee chair or a leader. And now suddenly somebody finds them, you know, somebody's in the speaker chair or the chair of appropriations, and you find out they're a stinking kook.
John, do you have any thoughts? And you know me, I'm really into campaign finance. We've known each other for a long time. I mean, I think, and you've witnessed this, you know, particularly when you were lieutenant governor, we started to see the emergence of outside money, not party money, not caucus money, not candidate money, but outside groups. Now we have super PACs, of course. Can you reflect on that in terms of you think that's had an impact on our politics? And if so, what kind of impact of this enormous, I mean, a lot of candidate races now, the biggest spender is a super PAC. It's not the caucuses, it's not the candidate, not the party. It's a super PAC. Any reflections on what you think that's done to our politics?
I believe the notion of disclosure is an important thing to happen. It's important to know where the money's coming from. And to do that, all of a sudden, you got to put in place all sort of reporting requirements. And once you start to do that, you really create a situation where people who raise money, spend money, have to be very competent about how to do that. And all of a sudden, if they're very competent about that, they become very competent about creating vehicles to operate within that system. I mean, that's why, you know, reform isn't necessarily a good thing, isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's simply a change. And so there are people who learn to operate within that change and begin to control the process. If you've given money to candidates, if you've tried to influence the process, and now you've got a report, you become much better at doing that. And as you become much better, you spend more money, and everybody's focused on that process. I mean, there's some unhealthy things that go on, and maybe it's the nature of having that kind of money in the system. And maybe the answer is not diminishing the reporting, but maybe limiting the extent to which money comes into play. But I think a lot of this is because we have to become much better at doing what has been done. I mean, you see that too at the staff level. I mean, the staff is much more competent and have a great deal more expertise than was the case when I went to work for the legislature back in 1974. I mean, that was almost where staff all of a sudden became a new institution. The legislature began to look at the staff in that context, and it changed the dynamics. It brought some competency into play, and that's got good impacts, and it's got bad.
John, I'd like to switch to another set of races, if we can. There were some interesting races on the congressional level yesterday. I don't know how closely you followed all that. Interesting race in West Michigan, where Congressman Myers obviously was punished, I think, for his pro-impeachment vote in a district now that is pro-Democratic. And we got a real Trump MAGA believer winning that primary. We had a very difficult primary among Democrats, Stevens and Levin, down in Southeast Michigan, which unfortunately one of them had to lose, and we lost Andy Levin. Any reflections on what you saw happening in our congressional primaries yesterday and what that means?
Well, some of that, like the Levin-Stevens race, I mean, that's every time there's redistricting, you get that kind of activity. I mean, that's not out of the norm. And as you say, it's unfortunate that you get two good members of Congress and one of them loses. I mean, that's the nature of it. I'm amazed, that Sherry Thielander was able to win a congressional seat. I mean, that's just, it's a seat that you would assume would be an African-American seat. And the fact that he won it, now all of a sudden the dynamics, the partisan dynamics, the dynamics of the Democratic Party changes dramatically in this redistricting process. I mean, that's not confined to Congress. Same thing's playing out in the state Senate and in the state House. And that will have significant impacts on the Democratic Party itself and how the party handles that. So I think as someone who's not serving anymore, I'd say, oh, that's a fascinating phenomenon. And I'll be interested to see how that plays out. And of course, the Meyer race, that is, boy, you talk about the epitome of the problem that the Michigan Republican Party has. It resided right in that race. I'll be honest with you, I was a bit shocked. I mean, I thought Peter Meyer had a good, solid leadership base in Western Michigan, the Grand Rapids area, and that he would survive that kind of challenge. And I guess that tells me that there's much more depth to what's transpiring in the Republican Party than I had even thought there was.
Yeah, I wonder what role. I think there were some Democratic crossover votes there that might have played a factor as well. But yeah, I think you're right, John, basically that I think many people have underestimated the power of Trump. I mean, he didn't do badly yesterday in Michigan. I think he can take credit for some of Tudor Dixon's margin. I think about half of the legislative candidates he endorsed won. So I think he's going to claim credit there. And of course, you know, with Gibbs' victory against Meyer, that's something that Trump is going to trumpet as well. So, and Jeff has been really good about continuing to point this out, that despite what the pundits say, Trump remains a very powerful factor, certainly in the Michigan Republican Party.
Yeah, well, I think that you nailed that. We're going to see stories and commentary about, oh, yeah, Trump's powers. He only got half of the electorate, or, you know, his endorsed candidates in the legislature. So his power is waning. He toppled a sitting senator in a primary, and it wasn't even close yesterday, Kim Lasada. You know, that's, he took a scalp, and it was a serious one, because, you know, what, incumbent legislators seldom lose. Yes, redistricting is when it happens, if it does typically, but they seldom lose primaries. And there's only, I think, been four incumbents in the last 20 years on the Republican side, at least, who've lost in a primary. And it was astounding that race wasn't even close. It was like 2/3, 1/3, with an incumbent there. And that's based solely on the power of Trump's endorsement. And when you look at the race where Alana Tice or Greg Van Workum in the House up in Muskegon, where they had Trump faced or Trump endorsed challengers that they fended off, and, you know, in a kind of a 60-40 fashion, they won in fine fashion, but they did it not by repudiating Trump. They did it by cozying up to Trump and trying to blur the lines between them and their opponent. That's how Trump has dominated the entire process, is that the needle has moved from normal, what would have been normal, traditional mainstream Republicanism to what we have today. And that's why I said, when the abnormal has become the normal. And when you have somebody like a Tudor Dixon, and I mentioned this before we started recording, you had John Engler standing at this unity event between Tudor Dixon and Michonne Maddock, looking like he had lost a bet and was forced to be there. And it really,
we're unhappy.
Yeah. And I was thinking, why show up to something like that? Just let it go, man. Go count your money and go to Texas. Hang out. You know, it just shows how the needle has moved, and there's this desire to kind of this normalcy bias to say, well, Tudor Dixon wasn't arrested by the FBI. She didn't breach the Capitol on January 6th, and she didn't like inject bleach on her YouTube channel to ward off COVID. So she's a normal. She's team normal. That's kind of not the definition of normal to me, if you don't do these crazy things, but that's the way the party has shifted.
You know, Jeff, I mean, you're exactly right that Trump played a role here. Now, the issue is, what other things played a role? And I don't know, I wasn't observant enough about the Republican primaries, but what I noticed on the Democratic side was there are a lot of new faces, new names that I didn't recognize. But what I saw happening, and I think I want to examine this a bit more, is I think a lot of the primary winners on the Democratic side were people who figured out how to go back to the old style of personal politics in a new way. And in other words, that it involved face-to-face contact. You didn't rely necessarily on leadership to deliver it for you. You figured out a way to maximize what leadership support you had, but it all boiled down to being able to work the voter and getting a sense, convincing the voter that you were a person that they could trust. Now, I mean, I kind of saw that play out in a number. I saw some people that I didn't expect to win, and I think they did it because they worked harder than their opponent did. I don't know if that same phenomenon was transpiring on the Republican side, but, you know, I think when you've got all this newness, people who can do it best have an advantage. And I think that was part of what played out yesterday as well. And why I think, you know, I kind of partly say to myself, you know, I've kind of been left behind here, that there's a new politics out there. There are new people, and they may rewrite some of, you know, what we have known to be the case here in Michigan.
One of the things I saw yesterday, and we saw a lot of this in 2018, but I think it's continuing in the Democratic Party. I'd be interested in your thoughts on this, John, would be I think there's a positive bias toward female candidates. In my home county of Macomb, an incumbent state rep, Rep. Steenland, from a longtime Roseville family, out of the blue yesterday, lost to a new candidate. She may have done some of the things you just talked about, John, but I think her gender had something to do with that. And I think that's out there, certainly on the Democratic side. And, you know, these male incumbents, particularly in the Democratic Party, got to watch out. They can't take these districts for granted if they're running against strong, organized female candidates.
Well, I think that's exact. I mean, that is clearly there. I mean, I don't buy into this, but you even see some males reacting that way and saying, you know, I'm being canceled. I think if you can get out there and make your case, and you need to do that. But women are politically more aggressive now, and they have every right to be. They've kind of been held back, and now they're exercising the power and strength that they're finding that's at their fingertips, and you can't blame them for that. And you know, sometimes you kind of take your position for granted, and if you're taking yourself for granted, someone's got to come along and clean your clock.
I think that's what happened to Representative Steenland, and God bless him, good Democrat, but I don't think he worked hard or worked hard enough in that primary. I think he was kind of taking it for granted. And again, we saw a lot of this in 218 and McComb and elsewhere around the state. Can't take it for granted.
You know, women have gotten very good, too, of supporting themselves, supporting each other. And that's given them some degree of advantage. I don't blame them. I mean, that's smart politics.
You know, I'm curious, the take, and I've heard this a lot today, and I've been talking to some reporters and other stakeholders in the process about this today. The Republicans seem to really believe that the fact that Tudor Dixon that they nominated the woman, the only woman running to go up against Gretchen Whitmer, will somehow transform the debate on abortion rights. The fact that a pro-life woman won the Republican nomination supports the 1931 law will be somehow accepted by women voters more palatably than if it was Garrett Saldano or Kevin Rinke holding those same positions. What do you think? Do you think the fact that a woman has extreme, I think, what fall outside the mainstream positions on abortion, especially with the no exception for rape or incest like Tudor Dixon has, do you think that women are going to be willing to overlook that because she's a woman? Or is that, am I correct in that that's a pretty bad misreading of the room here?
It sounds to me like a convenient media angle on a story that doesn't reflect reality. I mean, you're exactly right. If an individual feels strongly about what they believe to be their own personal rights, they are not going to give that away because the person's of the same gender that they are. And one example, I mean, I can't figure this out. Maybe you got an insight on this, but I'm thinking of a Republican state like Kansas. They turn around and vote to negate an effort to diminish reproductive rights. So, I mean, there's disconnect there on the surface. Now, I know there's got to be a logical explanation. I'm not sure what it is, but it just strikes me as, oh, that's really different. How did that happen? Because somehow, Jeff, I think what you're talking about is wrapped into that question.
There's a tendency for people who report on, who pontificate about elections, to look at everything through the lens of history. Say, well, in normal, in historic midterms, blah 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 happens. The party in the White House. I would agree. I know political history, relatively well. And I know what the results have been. And most of those elections have been referendums on the incumbent. They are an up or down on the satisfaction with the incumbent in Washington. There seems to be something different at work here. And I don't know if it's simply a result of the Dobbs decision overturning Roe or not, but it seems to have changed the dynamic where we're no longer just dealing with an up or down referendum on the popularity or approval of Joe Biden's job. But this is a choice between two competing philosophies. And I think voters, not just in Michigan, but across the country, Kansas is a great example, are looking at this and thinking, hold on, this, I might not be happy with what Biden is doing. I don't like paying what I'm paying for gas, but my God, you're talking about forcing a 10-year-old girl to have a baby. That's just a, you know, hold on. I can't buy what you're selling. Even if I'm, you know, I'm mad about the environment, I'm mad about the economy or whatever it is. And so this seems like much more of a choice between two competing visions of what America should be or could be than it is a referendum on the, you know, what's going on in Washington.
It's almost like the issue has slipped out of a partisan frame into some different frame.
Yeah. Yeah. We have one data point, and that's the election in Kansas, but it's a pretty powerful one. When you look, we've been some people I work with, we've been looking at the change in vote turnout increase in counties in Kansas based on 2018, the last similar election. The no vote on the proposal, that which was to support choice in Kansas, compared to the Trump vote or the Biden vote. And it's really significant. There was a lot of Republicans. First of all, there was a massive turnout increase. People turned out to vote for that issue that hadn't voted in previous primary elections in Kansas by a massive number, by, you know, in some counties, double previous high water marks. But there was a good 20, 25, even 30% of Republicans, registered Republicans, who had to have, when you start doing the math in these counties, who had to have chosen to leave the language in their state constitution. And these are probably people who might consider themselves pro-life, might be even part of that part of the Republican Party, but they're not willing to go so far as to risk criminalizing their sisters, their daughters, their granddaughters, doctors, when it comes to a healthcare choice.
Which also tells me that Democrats have to be careful about making the assumption that the abortion has its frame now is simply going to mean a greater Democratic turnout. I mean, I think the issue has escaped the partisan frame.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there's great danger. The Republicans, if they're still thinking about a red wave, I think they're really misreading what the fall is likely to be. But by the same token, I think that the Democrats could look at what happened in Kansas and infer from that some of the wrong takeaways, that there's definitely an anger and a palpable change in the enthusiasm among Democratic voters after Roe, but they've got to do a good job of making that an issue in a contrast with the Republican opponent, and do it in a way that doesn't alienate some of those prospective centrist voters or moderate Republican voters who might be with them on this issue.
I mean, I think you're right. And so if I was a Republican candidate right now, I'd be trying to figure out what message I could send that would suggest that I lie outside that partisan frame. I don't even know if that's a tightrope that can be walked. But I don't think you try to nail yourself into this current partisan frame. You try to suggest that, hey, you know, there's a little Kansas in me. And I don't think Tudor Dixon's prepared to do that.
Yeah, I mean, there's already ads running that have basically the excerpts of Tudor Dixon giving an interview where she very clearly said no exceptions for rape and incest. We're going to see that every day between now and the election. And I think the governor, even before Dobbs, was talking about abortion every day. She's going to keep talking about it at every opportunity. But Jeff is right. I mean, you got to be careful how you handle this so you don't come across as the extremist either.
Right.
Or that you're taking your voters for granted on this issue. But I think there is potential here to help Democrats if they do it correctly. If they do it correctly.
In football, it's called an influence plot. You help put somebody in the direction they're already headed. And I think that's the problem Tudor Dixon has, and she's headed someplace, and she's easy to push there.
You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think we've ever had a regular November election where abortion has been on the ballot. We had the 1989 special election to ban public funding for abortions, but that was a special election, if I remember correctly. So I don't know that we've. So what I'm saying is it's going to be an overarching issue with tens of millions of dollars spent on the issue of advertising on abortion rights. Candidates are going to be. They're going to be forced to deal with this every single day for the next 97 days or whatever we have left.
Well, actually, Jeff, and I was in high school when this occurred.
Okay.
In 1972, there was a ballot proposal pre-Roe that would basically would have brought a version of Roe to Michigan. It was overwhelmingly defeated. But this state, as we all know, is vastly different from the state that voted in 1972. Vastly different. I know that, and we see a lot from the Republicans and Right to Life saying, oh, these proposals were defeated in the past overwhelmingly. I don't think that 72 example is relevant at all.
Yeah, a few things have changed in the last 50 years.
Yeah.
We've touched on it a little bit, the battle for control of the legislature. I think at the end of the day, I've been in the room many times when the Republican hierarchy would get together and kind of make their strategic decisions about where the election is going. I mean, I remember very clearly in 2006 and 2008, recognizing the holy crap, the tsunami that's about to hit us and trying to save the women and the children, get as many people as we can into lifeboats. And at the end of the day, I know that the Republicans, I think, are very emotionally invested in defeating Governor Whitmer, whether or not intellectually they have a great path to do that. But I think that they have to, from some of the traditional donors, the Chamber of Commerce, the traditional Republican money sources, I think that they're going to be very keen on trying to preserve their legislative majorities. I mean, they've had the Senate for going on 40 years. They've had the House for, most of the last 30 years, and they want to keep, both and certainly, one of the chambers. John, you've been involved in those caucus battles going way back. How do you see the lay of the land post redistricting in this environment? How good a shot do the Democrats have to wrest majority from the Republicans?
There are a lot of balls in the air this year. And if things are going to change, it's most likely to happen when things are up in the air. I mean, there are new districts, new personalities, new contexts. We've got all of these. The pandemic and economics are just so much up in the air. The potential and the districts have changed. So, I mean, there is potential for all that to happen. I think you're right. It's been my experience. The Republican leadership is going to, I mean, the party's the established leadership is going to zone in on the legislative battle. And consequently, that means there'll be a little battle in the Democratic Party where are you going to invest your money? Are you going to invest in the legislature? And, of course, the top of the ticket's going to be saying, hey, the better off we do, the better off you're going to do. You need to invest your money here. That's a typical Democratic battle. Mark will test for that.
That's John and I, we've been through that a few times.
And that is going to play out to the max this year. But there is, and that is, the problem the Republican establishment has is they let Tudor Dixon swing in the wind too much, then that will in fact happen where the top of the ticket will overwhelm the process. I mean, so there's several things the Democrats have got going. And I think for that reason, it makes sense that people think Democrats have got a chance. But, having a chance and bringing it home are two different things. And so we're going to, Democrats could sure use a Neil Stabler right now.
Well, at least we don't have to deal with those Jeff Timmer mats, maps, John, eh?
And I like to say when I ran the Republican Senate operation in 1998, we hit our high water mark in the pre-steroid era. We got to 23 seats, and that was before they got up to those gaudy numbers like 26 and 27. But that was done with the aid of some really crazy maps, and without people like Gildanello around.
So. Right, exactly. Yeah.
Well, I will want to be respectful of your time. You know, I don't know if there's anything else, Mark, that we haven't covered. But you know, Lieutenant Governor John Cherry, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experience, your insights, your observations. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. You look great. Looks like retirement is agreeing with you, and I'm so happy for you.
I am enjoying life, you know, and I say, you know, Jeff, I appreciate this. I've often said right now, I mean, I started my college career in 1969 in political science, and I said, doggone it, I wish the environment in 69 had been what it is today. I mean, today, to be a political science student would be an opportunity of a career because there is so much change happening. And it's fun to think about, fun to talk about.
Yeah, John, you've been a great student of history and political science your entire life. And well, we're all the better for that. And we appreciate you sharing that with us today.
Well, thank you. I enjoy listening to you guys in other environments. You know, MSNBC today. Jeff, you did a good job.
Oh, yeah. I got a face made for radio. So.
Well, thanks again, John. Great to see you.
Great to see you. Thank you so much.
Well, this week's discussion has really flown by. And we want to thank our friend John Cherry for his seasoned wisdom on the state of Michigan electoral politics.
We are now officially in the home stretch of what promises to be an expensive, explosive, and pivotal Michigan general election campaign. We'll be back next week with the very latest developments.
As always, we welcome your questions, comments, and suggestions. Email us at arepublicpodcast@gmail.com.
If the Republic is still standing, we'll be back next week. I'm Jeff Timmer.
And I'm Mark Brewer. Thanks for listening.
You can subscribe to A Republic If You Can Keep It on all major podcast sites. A Republic If You Can Keep It is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.